This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Here in the United States, freedom's kind of a big deal. In fact, the Founding Fathers used the words freedom and liberty a lot while crafting the Constitution. Now, over 200 years later, we are still studying those words and their meaning.
I do think its meaning is fixed, and at least the principles it's laying out. We're constantly going to have to be adapting how we act within it to new circumstances.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk to a professor who says that liberty is the lodestar of our governing document. We'll also hear about a group of students suing for a better environment, attend the reenactment of a pivotal battle in the War of 1812, and spend an academic minute trying to find some peace and quiet. I'm Bob Barry, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Liberty is the guiding light of the Constitution. That's pretty much the gist of a lecture given by Dr. Adam Carrington, an assistant professor of politics at Hillsdale College in Michigan. I know this because I recently met Dr. Carrington and enjoyed his lecture. I thought you might enjoy hearing some of his insights, too. We spoke just before the lecture about his argument that liberty is the Constitution's lodestar.
That is the argument that I'm going to at least try to make, recognizing that that's a very debatable one. But I start with the Constitution itself saying that one of its guiding principles, one of the reasons why it was put into being, is to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity in its preamble. And something I'm going to try to show is that there are ways that the original Constitution and the amended Constitution do make that a focus and goal, and how even the other goals of the Constitution are subordinate to it.
After 200 years, people still read that document and 10 people can get 10 meanings out of it.
Well, sure. Actually, the founders understood that. Madison in Federalist, I believe it's 37, talks about the difficulty of language to communicate, but also the necessity of it to communicate. And I think that one problem that we have with the debating the various meanings is that we actually try to make the Constitution do too much. We try to make it solve every problem we have, rather than setting up a certain context in which we make a lot of decisions, but which only restrains certain things that are outside of certain bounds. But we try to make this too political often.
Do you think we are living in a freer society now than when this document was written?
That is a tough question. I would actually say yes and no. I think that yes, due to, I think, a further living out of its principles by the 13th Amendment, by greater recognition of the equal participation of women. And I think on a number of those, I think that the Constitution has become a fuller realization of what its stated goals were. At the same time, I do think that we struggle with certain parts of the government and certain parts of our society still not understanding fully, I think, what liberty means in the fullest sense. And I think some wanting the government to do too little, thinking government is the only threat, and some wanting government to do too much, and therefore not recognizing that we need government protections as well.
As someone who teaches the Constitution, do you think we'll ever stop learning and trying to figure it out?
No, I think that part of the reason being that the Constitution, while I do think its meaning is fixed, in at least the principles it's laying out, we're constantly going to have to be adapting how we act within it to new circumstances. While we may have set in stone, for example, a belief that people should not have their homes and persons violated by the government without a warrant, we're constantly in the age of technology going to be asking, well, what does that look like? And I don't think you have to deny a set view of what the Constitution means or deny that how that gets applied is going to change. And the fact is, drawing that line, I think, is going to be a constant part of politics. And I think those who frame the Constitution would recognize that and welcome us being participants in the political process by having that conversation.
It is such a uniquely American document, isn't it?
It is. It is. It really was. In Federalist 1, Alexander Hamilton says, we are trying to solve for the world, because he'd never lacked ambition. that whether governments can be established based on reflection and choice, or if we're ever doomed to have governments formed by accident and force. And the act of writing a constitution and saying we're going to obey it is a statement that human beings can govern themselves by reflecting and choosing what they think is right and wrong, good and bad, and a rejection of the idea that we are merely stuck with accidents of who got into power, force, the assertion of the strongest. And I think that the last 200 years has shown that while never perfect, we've shown an ability to do that that I think has also been imitated by others.
When you give a lecture like this, do you want people to come out with answers or more questions?
I want them to have a framework for how to think and discuss with each other. And so while I would certainly like them to have some basic questions answered, I want it to open up more. So to be honest, I'd want them to have more questions, not because I want to seed doubt, but I want to seed interest and further desire for inquiry.
Well, that's job security, if nothing else.
Yes. Kids keep coming and they keep asking, and I love that give and take in the classroom.
Dr. Adam Carrington is an assistant professor of politics at Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan. A group of young people are testing the limits of liberty guaranteed in the Constitution. They are plaintiffs in a suit in Washington State that argues that a stable climate system is a constitutional right, one that is as inalienable as any right conceived by the Founding Fathers. The students have gone to the courts, met with the governor, and lobbied the state's Department of Ecology. Their latest strategy is unveiling proposed climate legislation, which they argue needs to be based on the best available climate science, science that's been recommended for them by eminent client scientist James Hansen. Martha Baskin has the story.
The youth thought they'd secured a victory when a King County Superior Court in Seattle ruled in their favor this spring. The court directed the State Department of Ecology to issue new rules regulating greenhouse gas emissions by the end of the year. Ecology issued an updated rule this summer, its first since 2008, but it falls far short of what the kids and their lawyers say is required to stave off catastrophic climate change.
We have the laws on the books that say we need to protect air quality for present and future generations. We have a court order directing them to do so.
Andrea Rogers with the Western Environmental Law Center.
And what we don't have is action that's based on science.
Ecology is revising the rule after the public and Governor Jay Inslee weighed in and plan to present it to the legislature by the end of the year. But the youth and their lawyers aren't willing to wait and see what the revised ruling, the Clean Air Rule, mandates. So they announced at a press conference that they'd written their own legislation. Again, Andrea Rogers.
While we're pleased that Ecology used their authority to regulate carbon dioxide emissions, the rule doesn't get us even close to where we need to go.
The legislation, which was presented to both Ecology and Governor Jay Inslee in early September, is based on recommendations eminent climate scientist James Hansen and his team calibrated for the state. It calls for an immediate 8% reduction in annual emissions as a starting point from which to cut further over the coming decades. The state's revised Clean Air Rule calls for a much smaller cut of 1.7%. Hansen says governments worldwide continue to permit and otherwise support industry's efforts to fully exploit reserves of fossil fuels, something he calls, quote, at best schizophrenic, if not suicidal. 16-year-old Aji Piper, a youth plaintiff in the case, spoke at the press conference to announce the new legislation.
I know that we're asking for the moon. But wait, JF Kennedy asked for the moon. He got it. So why can't we children ask for the moon?
Going to the moon was optional back then, Piper told the crowd.
Our rights and obligations are not.
The idea that children or anyone have a right to a stable climate system, says environmental law scholar Mary Wood of the University of Oregon, is a fundamental one and goes back to the public trust doctrine, whose roots come from early Roman law. The doctrine states that the public has property rights to natural resources, water, land, shorelines, and even the atmosphere. Wood spoke with FSRN after the youth court case in Washington was heard late last year.
And this has been interpreted as a constitutional principle with constitutional implications in the sense that it holds even legislatures accountable, and certainly agencies accountable, like Department of Ecology.
The atmosphere, she emphasizes, is a public trust asset, which means government is a trustee and as such has a fiduciary obligation to protect it.
So it's really a very simple construct. As much as the agencies, the government attorneys, and certainly the industry want to complicate the matter, at some fundamental level, there's no complicating this right.
But even in a state like Washington that touts its green credentials, acting on this public trust doctrine and James Hansen's recommendations is open to interpretation. Chris Davis, Governor Inslee's advisor for energy and carbon markets, contends that the need to reduce carbon by 8% a year, or 10% by 2020, is a global target.
There is very little at all that I've seen science that explains how a small jurisdiction should downscale that data and decide what they're responsible for.
Davis contends that after last year's Paris climate talks, jurisdictions began trying to figure out how to set their limits. At the same time, he says the state is taking notice of California's new climate change law, which has a target of reducing emissions 40% below 1990 levels by 2030. Aji Piper isn't wasting any time waiting for action. He and others are using another tactic to influence the outcome of their court case and the Clean Air Rule, mailing letters to the CEOs of prominent corporations with a heavy carbon footprint in the state, along with those who have verbalized support for annual carbon reductions of 1.7%, which include BP, Chevron, and Shell. Piper also wrote a letter to the CEO of Puget Sound Energy, who generate about a fifth of their energy from a coal-fired power plant in Montana.
Do you know what climate change is? Do you really know what climate change is? Ask yourself this question.
Addressing the crowd at the press conference, Piper added that it was generally accepted that with great power comes great responsibility.
It is also accepted that knowledge is power. So if you have knowledge, I ask you to take responsibility. By reducing your business's carbon dioxide emissions by 8 to 10% every year.
Meanwhile, a youth-initiated federal climate rights case is being heard in Oregon. Juliana et al. Versus United States et al. Challenges the constitutionality of what it calls the nation's, quote, outsized role in creating the present climate crisis by authorizing, subsidizing, exploiting, and permitting fossil fuel projects and their lethal climate emissions. The government and three trade associations representing the fossil fuel industry filed motions to dismiss last year. The motions were overturned this spring, but the defendants again objected to the court's ruling. U.S. District Court Judge Ann Aiken will now hear oral arguments from lawyers representing all of the parties. Thanks to Ed Mays for video clips used in this story. This story was originally produced for FSRN and is brought to you by the Human Links Foundation. Engineering by Daniel Gunther. From the studios of the Jack Straw Cultural Center, this is Martha Baskin.
Still to come, before people went to the courts to fight for freedom, they did it on the battlefield. We'll see how one community commemorates their most famous battle next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. September 11th is an important date in American history, and not just because of the tragic attack 15 years ago. It was on that date, in 1814, that the Battle of Plattsburgh was fought, the final assault of the northern states in the War of 1812. Each year, the city of Plattsburgh in northern New York commemorates the battle, which is also known as the Battle of Lake Champlain, with a reenactment. That event was held earlier this month and celebrated the U.S. victory over invading British forces. Although many are aware of the pivotal battle on the lake, there were a number of land skirmishes as British forces marched south from Canada. The Best of Our Knowledge's Pat Bradley reports.
The sounds of battle echoed across an area that's now used for soccer, football, running, and recreation. Plattsburgh Mayor James Calnon narrated the battle, where American forces were pushed back from Culver Hill to the artillery assault on Halsey's Corners.
September 6th was to be an eventful day. British were on the march early that morning.
As reenactors appear from a distant hill to advance onto the north end of the parade grounds of the old base oval, volleys of musket fire between the British and militia are exchanged. Men and women in period costume kept the curious in the crowd out of the line of fire. New York State regulated militia captain Craig Russell explains the purpose of the skirmish.
We are portraying September 6th. The British had started out north of where we are. When they reached the ridge, which is to our right, we portrayed that as Culver Hill. And we culminated with the artillery barrage of three shots at Halsey's Corners. From there, the Americans withdrew, and tomorrow we continue with the battle on the bridge. General McComb had ordered men out to harass the British. It's very hard to take 1,000 people and think that you're going to stop 5,000 on the Beekmantown Road. So the object was just to harass them.
Following the battle, militia reenactors retreat to the shaded areas that encircle the battleground. 36th New York State Militia Manley Company, Sergeant Charlie Mitchell, is from Morrisonville, New York. He describes the preparations for this reenactment.
Our captain, who also runs the reenactment, has been out here several times with representatives from the city. And then last night, commanders from the British and U.S. commanders who are here this weekend came over and walked the site and so on. It's pretty well planned out. There's a group from the city who works very carefully with reenactors. It may not seem it sometimes while it's taking place, but it really is very, very well thought out. But when the muskets start going off, anything could happen.
That led to a discussion about their muskets. Mitchell notes that there are safety officers among the crowd because the weapons could do damage. Richard Bellotti, who traveled from Albany to join the militia reenactment, notes that the mechanics of the weapon have not changed.
Even the reproductions operate exactly the same. The only difference is they're made with stronger modern materials, generally, but it's steel, it's brass, it's wood. There's not that much different from the originals.
You have to load them the same way as the people in the militia back then did?
No, ma'am. We do not ram ball. Like, we don't put a ball down the barrel. Obviously, that's the killie bit. And we do not put ramrods down the barrel. There's the possibility that someone could forget it and fire it downrange, and that is a gigantic safety no-no. So we just pour powder in the pan, pour powder in the barrel, elevate, and fire.
So you're not shooting out any sort of
projectile? Aside from the burning powder, no.
The blast cloud is hot gases coming out of the barrel, which can burn. But Bellotti explains there are a number of stringent safety regulations.
We can't fire if someone's standing at a certain angle in front of us, and he knows the best.
Basically, the musket is a blast furnace.
Tom Wallens jumps into the conversation.
When you pull the trigger and you ignite the powder with the flint and steel, the powder will burn in the pan, shoot straight into the touch hole like a fuse. It will build up enough pressure and blast that powder out. What doesn't get burned in the barrel burns outside the barrel, and it'll shoot a blast out 6, 7, 8 feet.
Bellotti showed how a blast guard on the musket protects the reenactor.
There is a flash that comes out of the pan, but right here,
yeah.
This is a flash guard. It directs the blast up instead of out to the side. So generally, our faces are at the back end of the stock. There's a foot difference. The powder going up, it's nowhere near as much as in the barrel. It's nothing to worry about.
One of the strict things that happened during the Revolutionary War, when a person who fought in the battle came to collect his money, his pension, the only way that they were handing pensions out to these soldiers, if they had a black cheek from the powder from the guy standing next to you, because you're standing shoulder to shoulder, when that black powder comes out, it'll go right into your skin and it'll burn. It's like an instant revolutionary tattoo.
Wallace, an experienced reenactor from South Hero, Vermont, says it's critical to know your musket well to survive.
When you're actually facing an enemy who's coming at you and all you have is a musket, a one-shot weapon that you have to reload and know how to do it, you learn fast. See, the thing is you don't want to think about loading it. You want to do it automatically so that you become a weapon that can be used. Every man on that field is like a piece on a checkerboard or a chessboard. It's maneuvering, it's positioning, it's checking the enemy. You know what they call the clouds of war, when the most smoke goes across and you can't see your enemy? That's where your enemy comes out of the fog at fixed bayonets at you, trying to catch you in the middle of loading so that your musket can't work, so you can't defend yourself. You can't be thinking about anything except making that musket work and listening to the commands. And that'll keep you alive.
The Battle of Plattsburgh Bay naval engagement was also reenacted during the weekend-long festival commemorating the 1814 events. Reporting for the Best of Our Knowledge, I'm Pat Bradley.
So sometimes you want to be out on a crowded, noisy battlefield, and sometimes you just want to be alone. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
When was the last time you were somewhere quiet? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Scott Campbell, associate professor of urban and regional planning at the University of Michigan, discusses solitude and its benefits in a more connected world.
Solitude has many benefits. It grants freedom in thought and action, boosts creativity, offers a terrain for the imagination to roam, and fosters empathy through reflection. Of course, solitude is not always welcome and can be experienced in different ways. It can be sought out deliberately, or it can be unintentionally stumbled upon. Both varieties can deliver on its benefits, but the latter may be headed toward the endangered species list. As MIT professor Sherry Turkle points out in her research, unintended solitude is no longer mandatory now that we have anytime, anywhere access to each other through ever-present mobile devices. Turkle points to boredom as a key reason why people choose their devices over a moment with their own thoughts. Beyond boredom, the literature suggests some other explanations as well. First, we live in a time when expectations for being accessible are riding high. Sociologist Rich Ling makes this point in his work about mobile media's transition from something new into a basic taken-for-granted assumption, like telling time. His point is well supported by research showing that 72% of young people in the U.S. feel they need to respond to messages immediately. Also, as mobile communication becomes embedded at the social level, it moves toward the background of our cognitive processing. People simply do not put as much conscious thought into their use of common artifacts, such as watches and now mobile media, when they become a taken-for-granted part of everyday life. Studies suggest that this is part of the reason why people text and drive. Now that unintended solitude is no longer mandatory, we might want to place more emphasis on deliberately carving out times, places, and activities for it, not just in the realm of atoms and molecules, but in the realm of bits and bytes as well.
That was Scott Campbell of the University of Michigan. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or any of the other national productions or WAMC podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.